Hello, and welcome to the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your weekly access to the best short stories read by great actors, recorded live in the US and the UK. My name is Cedaring Fox, Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
My name is Kirsty Pitt, Word Theater's UK founder and creative partner.
Today we have a special story that has been selected to launch on Halloween weekend. It is by David Means, who has new stories coming out in both The New Yorker and Harper's. This is the title story from his most recent collection of stories, Instructions for a Funeral, and it is performed by an actor whose voice simply melts me, Fred Melamed. To introduce his story, please welcome the author, David Means.
Hi, this is David Means. I began thinking about the story Instructions for a Funeral way back. I was ruminating a lot about what I wanted at my funeral, what kind of celebration I would want in relation to my own life. And I began writing down these instructions. And then somehow it began to morph into the story Instructions for a Funeral. It's a pleasure to hear Fred Melamed read my story. His voice and tones, I think he embodies the voice of the narrator in a way that no one else could. And it's a great pleasure to hear Word Theater's production.
Dear Morrison, as instructed, I've put down a few thoughts about a memorial service. I'll have this notarized later in the morning. The house is quiet. The river is catching dawn light. I've been up all night. As the mourners arrive, play Glenn Gould's version of the Bach French Suite No. 2 at a volume loud enough to mask the shuffling of feet and the scraping of chairs. And if it happens to be spring, the sound of birds outside. If it's early fall and the windows are open, then the dead leaf rustle. Include a note in the program. On good days, William Kenner felt the glory of existence in the phrasing, in the arched fingers striking the keys. He spent way too much time imagining Gould on the shore of the lake, hands deep into his pockets, head bent forward, with the Canadian sky looming over him. He spent too much time trying to connect Gould's so-called idea of North with his own Michigan idea of North. Those summer, midsummer chills that hit Petoskey. And that one night in particular, when the pine cones froze off the trees and drummed on the tin porch roof outside of his bedroom window. When everyone's seated, play like a rolling stone. Note in the program. When alive, Kenner spent too much time pondering Dylan's lyrics and never did figure out who that mystery tramp might have been. Although he did often like to think that that figure came out of the hinterlands. One more American sociopath, perhaps. And he knew the type from his own boyhood, having seen them come and go, taking his sister out at night, pulling up at the curb in the summer haze of the street lamp. Everyone should remain seated during this portion of the program, including Don Philpott, who, if he's still alive, will be nervously pinching the flesh on his upper lip, where as a teenager, he had a mustache. He'll be fidgeting because, I like to imagine, he'll be thinking about the Newberg deal. He might also be thinking about the time that the four of us went down to the Amish quilt auction in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and we all got into an argument about the emotions of the spotters. Philpott maintained that the men doing the signaling were intuitively manipulating the invisible field of energy, those were his words exactly, that formed around any kind of interaction that might lead to a deal. If you were keen enough, he claimed, you could tweak this field to your own advantage in the bidding. Next, play the original versions of Louis Armstrong's West End Blues, and then St. James Infirmary, 6 minutes, 31 seconds total, at which point, presumably, Philpott will break into one of his sweating fits, wiping his forehead with his handkerchief, adjusting his ass there on the seat, sulky with shame. Please note in the program the following. Kenner sat on the board of the New York State Real Estate Ethics Committee and chaired the Committee for Real Improvement in Real Estate. He worked tirelessly for justice. On the other hand, if it's clear that I was killed by Sullivan, please substitute the following. Kenner tangled with the evil gangster Sullivan, who in concert with a dear friend shafted him out of the land in Newburgh and proceeded to build the Highland Estates, yet another bedroom community of commuters who had to cross the bridge to catch the train in Beacon, when if I'd had my way, they might have taken the ferry that Kenner, I, was well on the way to putting into service, having already, at the time of the bid, through careful nursing of connections with the state, received all the permits and pilot certificates necessary to develop a high-speed Newburgh-Manhattan service. I pondered way too much time, not only the bedroom community that Philpott built, the cluster of nondescript buildings with terraces with unusually low railings. The jerk had the Newburgh building inspector in his pocket, too. But also the lives of those every day, rising at dawn, dressing quietly in the dark so as not to wake their wives or husbands, and then slugging across the miserable bridge to the train and the long ride down to the city, and then hours later, returning home in the dark, except in the summer, when the glorious Hudson Valley, bathed in warm dusk, would mock their servitude. Whereas I, through financial finesse and my intuitive sense of the volume needed to project my ideas past the scratchy noise of the real estate market, had found a way to spare the commuters such a fate. Just as Louis Armstrong, with his ability to play loudly and in tune at the same time, was able to project through the limitations of Victrola, and then later on of mono AM radio filled with static. His horn threw itself in front of the background noise, doing whatever it wanted to, joyful and strong. When the Armstrong piece is over, please ask for a moment of silence. If Philpott is alive and in attendance, with sweat beating on his brow and his long legs jittering, he will find this short pause unendurable. And he'll sense that Armstrong is mocking his inability to play the market honestly. Note, I'd like my body to be on display. Dressed in a clean white shirt, black tie, dark trousers, along with my hand-sewn Italian shoes. Please have them resold. I'd like the undertaker to clean up the razor-burn blemishes under my chin and trim my eyebrows and my ear and nose hairs. Please tilt the coffin slightly towards the room, so that a view of my body becomes unavoidable. If my face is disfigured by an act of violence, most likely at the hands of Sullivan, but possibly by Bob Hartwell, who had a grudge against me because of the tree-chopping incident, the border dispute, and the subsequent surveying expenses, and who stopped acting in a neighborly fashion sometime around 1991, do your best to clean up the blemish on my neck and the small crater on my left eyelid, which still bothers me, because I remember the cauterizing tool the dermatologist used, the unexpected burst of pain, and the smell of flesh burning. Again, if my face is a cubist mess, please present it to the mourners. Put a note in the program, or make an announcement after the moment of silence. It was William Kenner's wish that each of you take one last look at his face. Please make every attempt humanely possible to take at least one glance. even if this fills you with the sharp envy, you, Philpott, of knowing that he had the Archdiocese of New York in the palms of his hand when he negotiated the easement for the entry road to the retirement home for nuns, which later became fondly known around the town as the Nunnery. Kenner often admired the meadow property. Beautiful as the grass swayed in the wind off the river, only 30 miles north of Manhattan. Kenner had bought the meadow long before he moved to town. He and Anne rented a car, drove out of the city in search of a country house, a weekend retreat. And when they came to the meadow, with the palisade looming over the northern border, they got out of the car, waded there into the grass, and fucked each other senseless. Then on the way out, Kenner spotted a for sale sign and bought the land that would years later, retrospectively, even a score. One afternoon over lunch, we declared ourselves business partners of the old school type, willing to seal deals with a handshake and a smile. Why bother signing a contract when friendship and trust would suffice? You may recall, Don, my corpse might say, that Anne and I made a number of overtures of friendship to you and Marie. One of them was the invitation to join us for our annual trip to the Amish auction near Lancaster. These were, you recall, the days when we were keeping a tally of our dinner party invites. We owed you an invite equivalent to three of your parties. And I figured that even with your petty accounting, you'd see a trip to Amish country at our expense as the equivalent to eating Marie's food three times. I figured, and Sharon did too, that you understood that we attended your dinner parties out of compassion. Note to Morrison. If you're still alive and you're still my counsel when you get this document, or to Comstock or Swinburne if you take over my counsel, or whoever at Morrison, Comstock, and Swinburne happens to take on the job of tending to this document, here are a few key points. I intend, if I'm not killed by Sullivan, or in a freak accident of some kind, to continue telling my son the story of Philpott's betrayal as a lesson in how deep trust and friendship can be exploited for material gain. I intend to sit him down again and say, "Son, I don't know if you remember my old friend Don Philpott, who used to come over here to the house when you were a boy. My hope is to wait until I'm on my deathbed and tell him the story again, making use of the deathbed aura, the beep of the machine as a backbeat. I'll explain that our friendship went back to my childhood in Michigan before I moved out here. And I'll tell my son about the time when Don and I were slapping a puck around on Portage Pond. And on a dare, he skated as close as he could to the inlet where the creek went under the road. He fell through the pale blue ice, and I shimmied on my belly with my stick, spreading my legs to disperse the weight as I guided him to shore. And then I took off his wet clothes, wrapped him in my coat, and I took him to my car, where I cradled and hugged him to warm him. I saved his life. He said as much over the years. He said, 'I owe you my life, Kenner.' He said it over lunch that day. He said, 'You know that time you were playing around with that kid, Brent, you know, in the rail yard? You saved his foot. And then a few months later, you saved my life.' Well, that was not bad. I mean, most of us would be satisfied with saving one foot of life, but to save a foot and a life like that, that's a big, big thing," he said. And I said, "Don, it was nothing. All I did was help you slide along the ice to the shore, and it wasn't really that far. I'll tell my son that he thanked me again and again over the years for saving his ass." His ass, I'll tell my son. "He told me that I saved his ass. But you know, the way I think about it, I saved an ass. I'll stress that it's a dangerous thing to do business with an old friend. Precise memory vaporizes when it comes in contact with cash. Morrison, it's possible by the time these instructions get put into action, I'll have already told the story again to an older version of my son. So it is possible that my son will be giving Philpott the evil eye during this moment of silence. If you're alive and attending, please watch him. If he gives Don the evil eye, you can safely assume that he's heard the life-saving ice story as it relates to the Newberg betrayal story. If not, you can assume that I didn't have a chance to tell it to him again, because I died at the hand of Sullivan, who I might as well add here, called me the other night. At least I think. Someone called. With a thick accent or with a handkerchief over the mouthpiece. Do they still do that? And he spoke in a mumbled tone about vindication. I tried, and I'm still trying, to instill in my son a sense of compassion strong enough to develop into an ethos of love, so that he'll eventually be able to find it in himself to forgive a heinous, albeit typically American, act of financial violence, along with the betrayal of a handshake, an extended squeeze of flesh on flesh, and a big up-and-down shake that lasted for about a minute, as we chuckled and we agreed again that we were the best of friends and that no written contract was necessary. A sense of shared destiny threw us back to the Midwest. And I mentioned this to Philpott after the shake. I said, isn't it amazing that two fuck-up kids from the sticks are closing a friendly handshake deal for what might turn out to be the largest land grab north of Bear Mountain in years? Morrison, do you remember the conversation we had a few years ago in which you explained to me that one out of every 20 or so clients could be counted on to go against your counsel? You said it's often the most judicious clients, considerate ones, who go against the advice of counsel. And then in another meeting you said, it's counsel's advice that you keep your mouth shut about Sullivan. Just let it go. Don't attempt to approach Sullivan. Don't make public or even private statements about Newberg, Sullivan, or Philpott. As for the eulogy and all of that, I think I'll leave most of that to the living, whoever they might be, to plan that part of the service. Although let me say for the record that I'd like the Reverend Wu, if he's still around, to give one of his long-winded, incomprehensible sermons drawing from the book of Job and whatever passage that he can find that contains the word vainglory. Something from Philippians, perhaps. Note, please ask Wu to pound on the word vainglory. And then I assume there will be the usual personal comments from grieving family members. And then, if I live long enough, perhaps my son, perhaps young man by now, might get up and tell the story of my taking the train down to Yonkers to find Sullivan one clear winter day. Yesterday, to be precise. And going to his so-called social club, a ratty little building with windows covered with faded newsprint. I'd seen the building many times on the news during coverage of the so-called Boss War during the summer of 1987. When Sullivan was supposedly solidifying control of the Eastern Syndicate, as they kept on calling it. On television, it was a classic brick stone storefront with an old sign, Hudson Shoe Repair, with missing neon tubes. When I saw it in person, it looked astonishingly shabby. A stubby brick building and a block of high-rises and condos not far from the railroad station. In person, it seemed to radiate a sort of criminal desperation. Just seeing it from across the street filled me with confidence. The Sullivan gang, according to reports, was now fragmented and losing power by the day. I like to imagine that my son will use this story to illustrate my gumption, my fearlessness. And the truth is, I felt fearless. Fueled by my anger, my almost cosmic sense of betrayal. You, Don, you miserable liar, Judas, you handshake deceiver. I marched right up to the door, gave it a knuckle rap, and waited for an eye to appear in the eye hole. Someone on the other side of the door grunted a phrase. I knocked again, and I heard the grunt again. Password, the grunt seemed to be saying. And I said, I don't know the password. I'm here to speak to Sullivan. He doesn't know it, but he's expecting me. When the door opened, I was facing an old man with a cane. He was toothless, with one eyelid stuck shut. He kept one hand clutched behind the lapel of his tweed jacket, looked me up and down with his one good eye, and he said, "What do you want?" I said, "I've come in search of the truth about a matter." And he said, "What matter?" And I said, "It's an upstate matter." Let me stress here that I had an intuitive sense of how to speak. "Upstate how?" he said. And I said, "Upstate land." "Stay here," he said. And he closed the door, and he left me standing outside in the fresh air with the blue sky overhead. I stood and stood, and I felt my feet on the ground. I felt like a man who was ready to defend his honor. I felt like a man ready to defend his honor against the forces of evil, so to speak. I felt like a man standing outside an old shoe repair shop in the Yonkers business district, with the sound of the Metro North train arriving at the station a few blocks away, trailing a long strand of tension and stress as it tried to break to a stop. And then, a minute later, the repowering, the gathering steam. It was an express, I knew, because expresses were diesel-powered, so they could pass Croton, where the third rail ended, and head all the way up past Beacon to the end of the line in Poughkeepsie. The sound of the train leaving filled me with strength, I'll explain to my son. A minute later, the door opened, and the man appeared again, and he gestured me with a wave of his cane into a dark room that smelled of boot black and cleaning compounds and gun oil. There were a few old tables and even older chairs. The man led me back. He lifted a gate, and he pushed me behind a counter where, reclining in a chair, Sullivan sat with a cigar in his mouth, with a friendly look on his face. "If I'm dead now, Morrison, please know that it has something to do with the feeling I got when I saw his face. Because it seemed to me, as he gestured towards the chair, that he had honest eyes, deep twinkling blue eyes. It's also possible, if I'm dead now, and you're reading this a few weeks later, that I was fooled by his casual voice as he said, 'Go ahead, state your business. Just tell me who you are and what you want.' It was a fatherly voice, so I dove right in, and I told him everything from my point of view. I told him about Philpott, that's you, Don, and our early friendship, the time I saved his life on the ice in Michigan, and then about the handshake deal and the Newburgh land and our agreement to use state funds to finance a high-speed ferry service to the city. As I spoke, he listened attentively, and he swung his cigar in the air, making short looping gestures as if he was conducting. Again, his eyes seemed to twinkle as I spoke of the bond I'd felt with Philpott, one that came from sharing hour after hour of our boyhood days. We were further bonded, I explained to Sullivan, by our both having abandoned Michigan for the East Coast. As he listened, Sullivan's eyes seemed to tear up. Up until this point, I now see, I had not gone against your counsel, Morrison. I was simply a confessor, bemoaning a business deal gone sour. I was nothing but a lonely man in Yonkers on a clear, beautiful winter day, spilling his soul to a man who was notoriously quick-tempered, who had killed, according to news accounts, at least 100 men. He seemed, as he swung his hand, trailing smoke, to understand my honor as it related to risk and death. And I'm sure now as I write this, it's late and I've been drinking, that he understood up to a point my willingness to go against common sense. And I'd even say that he was impressed with me as he said, Go on. I get it. Go on. So you left the homeland for the East. So did I. Go on. I accuse Philpott, you Don, of conspiring with him against me on the silent bid for the Newburgh land. I implied, against the advice of counsel, that the two of them had been in cahoots against me, and that someone would have to pay for the crime somehow. If I tell this story to Gunnar, I'm going to stop right here, pull up short, and avoid describing being let out of the social club after shaking Sullivan's hand. I'll say I got confirmation that Philpott had truly fucked me. I'm going to keep it clean and simple. I'll avoid telling my son about the way Sullivan's face changed, about the way his eyes became dead, cold, blurry blue, and his lips became firm and tight against his teeth, in a smile that seemed politely politic, charged with the task of hiding a placid, benign malice towards his audience. As a matter of fact, Sullivan looked a little bit like old photos of JFK, beautifully haunted, as he looked out at the world with a gentility and authority tempered with physical pain. I'll avoid telling my son about the way Sullivan's attention went from me to his cigar, which he examined carefully, and then, after clearing his throat a few times, began to speak in a voice that was tight and intense. He told me about his best friend years back in Hell's Kitchen, back when Hell was still in the kitchen, he said. A kid named Kenny Bruin, and how they'd worked together, pickpocket schemes on the subway, this and that, until they were both working for what he called a higher establishment. And then one day, the fork appeared, he said. The big fork that always appears. And then he looked past me and he said, right, Johnny? Doesn't that fork always appear? Best friends, you're going to end up with that fork. It's going to happen. You're going to put trust in his basket and the other guy the same amount of trust in your basket. And then one of the baskets is just going to start to feel too fucking heavy. It's simple physics. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not relating this directly to your story. I mean, you and Philpott, what do I know? For all I know, he screwed you over because you pulled him off the ice. Maybe you should look at it that way. You might have done yourself a favor and left him to sink there like a stone. I mean, the way I see it, you should have let Kenny die before I had to kill him. On a roof, we were running from some punks, and he had to make a jump to another building. Nothing we hadn't done a million times before. And then he got snagged on an air vent or something. He lost his footing and he ended up... fuck if I really know how it happened. I didn't see it. He was hanging from the ledge like in a movie. I got his hands and I hauled him up. And we did like what you did. I mean, we hugged and we held each other. And Kenny said, you saved my life. I said, I didn't do anything you wouldn't do. He said, still, you saved my life. And now, when I think about it, I knew right then on that roof that I'd probably have to kill him if he kept on talking like that. And eventually I had to tell him. I said, Kenny, stop saying that you owe me your life. I don't want to hear it. You don't owe me a thing. Then a few years passed. I mean, time went along. We were doing a sit and wait on a guy who owed big on a horse in a raceway. So we were in the car for about like 12 hours waiting for this guy to come out. And we just had too much time. So Kenny starts going back to the old days and ends up talking about the time that he almost died and how I helped him out and all. And I knew right then, right there in the car, that I was going to have to kill him. It was just in the cards. Just by virtue of the fact that I knew he couldn't go on owing anyone so much without taking something from me. You see, that's the way it works, Sullivan said. And then he stopped speaking, and he stared at me. The room was getting dark. See, so what I'm saying is Philpott fucked you over, but only to give you the excuse you needed to kill him. You don't see it that way, but it is that way if you look close enough. Believe me, you give it long enough, you're going to feel it in your bones. Now, I'd like you to look at it from my perspective. Don is a good feed. I feed him lines, and he legitimizes deals and feeds me. He feeds me the take, and we both part ways until the next feed appears. If something doesn't happen to you, it'll happen to him. And I'm not sure that I can afford that. He drilled his eyes at me, and he said, I could kill you right now, right here, but that's not my style. Listen, you came to me and I asked you to talk. It's not my style to kill a guy who was asked to tell a story and then told it. I have other ways of doing things, he said vaguely. And then he made a gesture and the old man put his hand on my shoulder and we walked through the smell of shoe polish and maybe gun oil. I swear, Morrison, I smelled gun oil. And then I was outside in the wintry light. And then, right then, standing there, I understood that I was either a man who was going to be killed by Sullivan, or a man who, by some good fortune, was going to live on into old age unless I died of some other cause. And weirdly enough, Morrison, I felt better knowing that these two possibilities were in play. On the train home, I felt a weight lifting. The river outside was flowing with steely resolve. My options, which before the meeting had seemed innumerable and impossible to pin down, suddenly seemed delightfully few and clear. As I write this, Anne is asleep upstairs. I just texted my son. He was asleep too, making his little snoozy sound, with the faint twilight coming into his room through the window. Everything now is safe and cozy.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Fred Melamed reading David Mean's story, Instructions for a Funeral. And if you did, please spread the word. We are counting on you, our listeners, to share the news that we have a weekly short story podcast. Tell your friends. Also, you can support the work that we're doing at Word Theater, and you can support our authors by purchasing their books at bookshop.org/shop/wordtheater. And be sure to visit our website, wordtheater.org, to learn how to become a contributing member. We are a nonprofit organization. All proceeds support the creation of our programs and the recording, mixing, mastering, and distribution of our live events. Right now, we have our London events available online and several cool events coming up that are free for our contributing members. So come on and jump on board.
We're so proud and incredibly grateful to all these outstanding actors who come back again and again to work with us at Word Theatre.
Thank you, Jonathan Sachs, for composing our theme music, Joseph Cho, our technical director, and Jonathan Escobedo, this week's editor. This is Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles.
Until next week, Kirsty Pearn in England, signing off.